Tonight's show is sponsored by Recycle Processes, Inc. and Sakat Foundation of America. Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings be upon you. Good evening. You're listening to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM Chicago, Illinois. I'm your host, Olivia Richardson. Radio Islam is a live call and talk radio program airing every day from 6 to 7 p.m. Central, and we reach the world by streaming live at radioislam.com, where you can tap into all of our prior shows as well. This is a pre-recorded program. If you'd like to comment on what you hear tonight, you can post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/radioislamusa or tweet at Radio Islam USA. To re-listen, check out our SoundCloud, www.soundcloud.com/Radio Islam USA. We're talking with Dr. Shaban Amir tonight. Shaban Amir is an assistant professor of anthropology and general education coordinator at American Islamic College, Chicago. She is the author of the award-winning book, Muslim American Women on Campus, Undergraduate Social Life and Identity, the first ethnographic research study of Muslim American college students and Muslim American women. She joins us to talk about her research and finding inclusion on college campuses. Enjoy. I guess the first question, what are the questions that your book explores when we're talking about Muslim women on college campuses?
My book draws upon Muslim American college student stories, and I try to interpret them in Muslim American women on campus. And so what I use in the book is raw data, which is quotes from in-depth interviews with them. And some of the questions I look at are, for example, what are some of the cultural pressures that Muslim American college students negotiate? Or, and how do they balance their Muslim identity and their religious observance with the expectations and the norms of mainstream American college life? But also, kind of segueing from the second one, is what are some ways that Muslim students engage and deal with alcohol culture, dating culture, and fashion practices on campus? Okay. So those are some of the key questions I look at.
Okay, awesome. So why did you decide to study and write on this topic?
That is a good question. So when I was thinking about research, I was a PhD student. I had a number of different projects that I wanted to do. And at that time, and even now, but more so at that time in 2000, the state of research on Muslim American communities was very, very low. Mm-hmm. There was almost nothing about Muslim college students. And even when I, after I published the book, there wasn't really much even after that. So my choices were sort of between, looking at, school students, so minors, and at college students. And one of the advantages of looking at college students for me was that I could focus on issues of gender. And remember, this was 2001, so we were looking at the sort of the fallout of 9/11 and the American kind of project in Afghanistan, this all this talk in the American government about we're going to go to Afghanistan and Muslim women are oppressed and we need to help them and save them. And so that kind of gender talk around religion is something that I wanted to kind of mess with. I wanted to kind of trouble all the talk that was going on. So looking at Muslim college students allowed me to do all kinds of things. It allowed me to look at mainstream American culture. It allowed me to look at the relationship between Muslim Americans and their home in America. And it allowed me also to look at gendered religiosity and how that plays out in Muslim communities as well. So that, among other things, are some of the things that my book looks at.
What was your research like? Like, how did you go about necessarily finding all this information?
Oh, be careful, because all anthropologists love to talk about their methods. So my research method is what's called ethnography. So we do ethnography when we really want to get to know a culture. And when the culture that I wanted to know was Muslim American college student culture. And so in order to do that, I didn't want to just fly in, do some surveys, talk to a couple people, and then say, here's what I can tell you about Muslim American college students, which unfortunately some research tends to be like that. But what I really wanted to do was immerse myself into Muslim American college student. And the example I sometimes give for ethnography is like when you're eating milk and cookies, right? And you dip your cookie into the milk. And then when you dip your cookie into the milk, the cookie becomes kind of half milk and half cookie, right? So that's partly what the anthropologist does when she is immersing herself into a culture to understand it. So that's what I really wanted to do. So what I did was I went and spent a lot of time with two Muslim college student communities in D.C., in Washington, D.C. And I did a number of interviews there, more than 100, with college students, and I picked 26 primary women to interview multiple times over a period of about 18 months or so. So that was one of my main research methods.
Wow, that's pretty intense, actually.
It was a lot of fun.
Alhamdulillah, good. So, like, was your research, was there a particular focus, like immigrant women, born Muslims, converts? Like, did you get a
wide
sample?
Yeah, that's a really good question, too. So, so I had, again, I could go into all kinds of directions. And the direction that I picked in terms of sampling is when you pick a particular research subject population, right? So the sample that I picked would determine what the research would end up looking like. So I decided that I was going to focus on Muslim Americans. And so they would be college students, undergraduates who identified as Muslim and who were also American citizens and who had grown up in this country. So those were my focus for this particular research. It would have been a different kind of research if I had decided to make it open to international students and so on. But for this particular research, I decided that my focus was on Muslim Americans. And like I said, I had 26 young women who were my main research respondents. They were all from a wide variety of racial and ethnic backgrounds. South Asians, Iranians, Arabs, African Americans, and also I had some white converts, one black convert, and one mixed race Latina convert.
Okay, great. So then, what did you kind of find, especially, like, I'm kind of interested in, like, the post-9/11, you know, these women getting onto campus and then sort of mixing in with American culture. Like, what were some of the findings that you found within your research?
Right. So if we're thinking, so I can talk about Muslim women. I can talk about Muslim college students. Of course, we're looking at Muslim women who are college students, but I'm going to kind of divide that up into boxes just to help us talk about it. So in a lot of popular culture, you'll find this assumption, this stereotype about Muslim women, right? That people seem to assume that they're oppressed, that their faith oppresses them, Muslim men oppress them, they have no choices in what they do, and they're just kind of one box. Like, people think they can predict what they're like as soon as they know that they're a Muslim woman. So one of my main findings, and for me this wasn't a finding, but it was more like a duh, you know, kind of finding, that there were so many different ways of being a Muslim woman that you really could not predict who they were and what they would end up being. So in terms, for example, if you look at religious observance, how to be religious, there was a significant diversity of levels and types of religiosity. So I had Muslim women, for example, who prayed Salat regularly. They fasted in Ramadan, wore hijab. They practiced premarital sexual abstinence, et cetera, et cetera. And I had also respondents who occasionally or sometimes embodied these practices. But I also had participants who were fully assimilated in the campus social culture, mainstream culture, and attended bars, nightclubs, and in some cases also dated, and in some cases dated casually as well. All of these women identified as Muslim. So despite what you learn from popular culture about Islam and gender, there's not one single way to be a Muslim woman. But for all of them, no matter what they were like, and no matter what they wore, and no matter how they behaved, all of them were constantly encountering that stereotype about them being oppressed and immobile and uptight, un-Western, traditional, and so on. So for all of them, they were constantly encountering the question about, are you religious? If you're not religious, why aren't you religious? Because you're Muslim. So the assumption is that you must be a religious person. And then again, that assumption about what a Muslim religious person looks like was always there. Like, well, you're not wearing, for example, a particular type of clothing. How can you say that you're a religious Muslim woman? So there was always that kind of stereotype about Muslim women. And of course, if you look at what it was like for Muslim students on campus in general, that's another set of findings as well that I can talk about.
Actually, would you mind?
Yeah, I'd love to. So one of the key things that I found was this issue of stigma. So there's a sociologist called Irving Goffman, and he looks at a number of different types of populations that he researches, and he finds that in many cases people encounter stigma, that is kind of a social stigma associated with particular characteristics. For example, being disabled, having a disability is often associated with a stigma. And then also people who belong to certain racial or ethnic categories often also encounter stigma. Now, a lot of people assume that when you go to college, particularly very liberal and elite kind of university communities, you assume that they've basically gotten over all that stigma. They're so diverse that surely they must be cool with everything. But what I found is that Muslims, American students, continue to encounter the stigma that's associated with being Muslim on the one hand, and also particularly being visibly Muslim or being visibly religiously Muslim. So those are the things that seem to make them not really belong in certain kinds of campus leisure culture. So I ended up focusing, and this was kind of a surprise for me, that I ended up focusing on social and leisure culture on campus, kind of the fun spaces, the spaces where people love to hang out, right? The spaces where people like to find friends. Because, you know, for a lot of young people, the most important thing about going to college isn't, oh, I'm going to take these courses and I'm going to hang out with the faculty. You know, professors like me, we love to think that is the the highlight of people's existence when they go to college. But really, the most important thing for a lot of young people is going to college and finding friends. Right, finding friendship circles.
Right.
But what I found was that in social and leisure culture, it is very often the place where Muslim students actually encounter the stigma that's associated with being a religious Muslim or being a Muslim. With that place, which is where people should connect, should network, find friends, hang out, be comfortable with themselves, that space, which is the focus for student life on campus, for Muslim students, they ended up being places where they've often felt marginalized and alienated. So that was really kind of difficult for a lot of the students that I spoke to. And so the places where they were, where everybody else was saying, oh, it's, we had such a good time, we met someone, we hung out, that those were the places where microaggressions were very often encountered. So where very often people assumed, oh, we'll go drinking, or we'll go clubbing, or we'll, you know, we'll hang out together in these different spaces. Those were the places where I found that Muslim American students were the most sort of emotionally and socially vulnerable. And I found, and this was odd to me because I hadn't gone into my research thinking about it, but I found that the hedonism, right, the pleasure-seeking aspect of campus life was something that ultimately ended up having an exclusionary impact on Muslim students, but not just on Muslim students. For any students who were like, you know, we don't want to drink all the time, we don't want to drink every weekend, or we don't want to, you know, go clubbing every weekend, or we don't want to hook up every weekend, that kind of thing. So these kinds of students ended up feeling like they were not at the core of campus culture, but they were at the margins of campus culture. So that was kind of an interesting thing to me. And that's why, if you pick up my book, you'll find that the three longest chapters in my book are about alcohol culture, and dating culture, and fashion and clothing. And some people are like, why? Why would you focus on these things when you're looking at Muslim American students? Well, this is why. It's because those were the main places, those were the main spaces, main cultural spaces where Muslim American students ended up feeling most alienated.
Wow. And so that actually makes a lot of sense, because I remember that was a huge debate on my college campus, was like,
right,
whether or not there are spaces for people to not have alcohol but still want to have fun and still feel,
right,
like they're a part of college.
Yeah.
So did the students, I imagine you got kind of close to them, did they ever find or make those spaces for themselves, or did they ever find a way to sort of still be themselves and feel a part of campus? Or
yeah, so this is an interesting thing, right? So, so like I said, there's not one single way of being a Muslim college student. And so in my book, I look at all of those different ways that people dealt with the peer pressure, but also the many different types of options that were available culturally in campus culture. So, for example, I had students who, you know, completely became part of mainstream campus culture. I had students who decided, you know what, we don't feel that we can best preserve our religious identities by becoming assimilated into campus culture. So, for example, I had students who were like, you know, I really want to figure out if I can be in that middle place, right? Sort of a middle place where I can not be isolated from campus culture, but I can also preserve my religious identities. But very often I found that they ended up saying, nah, it's not working for me. I'm not going to do this anymore. Because, for example, I have one research respondent, I call her Roshan. All of them have pseudonyms. I give all of them pseudonyms because of confidentiality and anonymity, because researchers are supposed to practice that. So she talked about, she used kind of a metaphor of having her, each of her feet being in two different boats. And she's like, you know, one of my feet is in this, you know, like this Muslim student group. I'm trying to be good. I'm trying to kind of grow my religiosity to the best. And the other side, I'm trying to stay with my friends from before and go hanging out with them in the evenings and the clubs and so on. And I just realized I couldn't do that, that I something had to give. And so she ended up, to some degree, isolating herself from her previous friends and becoming mainly part of the Muslim religious community. But it varied. I mean, she was one example, and there were others who said, you know what, I'm going to go because it's really important to me as an American Muslim to not be isolated from the mainstream campus culture. So if somebody invites me to a party, and this is something I'm sort of quoting from somebody, she said, if somebody invites you to a party, you should go, So that was kind of some of the attitude for some of them. They said, you really should go, and you shouldn't become isolated in a bubble. And so she would go, and she would go to, for example, if they're all hanging out at a bar, she would go there, and they would say, do you want a drink? And she would say, can I just get some orange juice? Right, so one of them, I call her Amira in my book, and she'd say, can I just have some orange juice? And they would say, okay, great. And she said, she sort of made a point of not saying, I don't drink, can I have some orange juice? Right? Because she said, you know, if you try to bring up that stuff, it's kind of like you're a party pooper. You're spoiling the mood in a way. So you don't want to do that. You don't want to be very adamant and kind of be very public about your religious identity. And then I asked the question, why is it such a problem, right? Yeah. What is wrong with this campus culture that you can't even mention that you're Muslim and you don't drink, right?
Right.
That there has to be something wrong with the campus culture that doesn't really allow for the visibility of a minority religious identity like that. So then I kind of go further into that, and I ask the question of what, you know, something needs to happen on campus culture, but more broadly in American culture, for it to be more inclusive and for these religious identities as well as ethnic identities to be automatically included and not to be sort of, you know, apologetically hiding in the sidelines, hiding in the margins and trying to pass as something else. So that's one of the things I use, right? Passing. That yeah. When you feel like your identity is stigmatized, is not popular, basically, is kind of stereotyped in mainstream culture, that you try to sort of not lie about it, but kind of keep a low profile for it. And that was one of the things that I found that many of my participants talked about doing, that they would sort of keep a slightly low profile, not lie about it, but just keep a slightly low profile and not make it very public. Because if they made it public, there would be consequences, like social consequences for it.
That's really complex, I think, really hard at some points, because you might feel like you're suppressing your identity.
Yeah. So that was one of my concerns, right? So people said, no, it's fine. It's what we need to do. It's how we need to adapt. And I would say, why should you need to do that? So I remember one of my research participants, I call her Yasmin. She said, but I've realized that I can't change the broader culture if I'm on the outside. I have to be inside the belly of the beast to make any change. And then I said, yeah, okay, that makes sense. But when you're inside and then you're trying to hide or kind of cover up your identity, then essentially it's like you're hiding something dirty. So the damage has already been done, right? So yeah. What change is going to happen when those identities have already been kind of brushed under the carpet as if they were something, some kind of contagion, some kind of contaminant? When you're already treating those identities like something dirty, then how is any kind of change going to happen with them?
Wow, yeah. So then, so for many of our listeners, one of the main concerns is like how to protect your faith when you go to college. And that sounds like maybe this can be sort of, you know, with your identity, you know, part of it's also your faith. So like how do Muslim students deal with like peer pressure and staying, I guess? Yeah. I guess you're saying like partially.
That is a really tough one, right? And yeah. I'm a parent myself. I have a little girl. She's 11 now, and I'm already thinking about college, right? And a lot of parents think about this, and a lot of college students also think about, a lot of high schoolers think about this, right? When we go to college, what's going to happen? Because this is for the first time for many students, for many young people, this is the first time that they're possibly going to go away from home, right? This is the first time that they're going to have much more freedom with their time and much more mobility as well. So what do they do with that, right? And there's kind of a sense of fear as well as a sense of excitement at the same time, right? For many people, they say, oh, college is where you go and you figure out who you are, So that's kind of a narrative around college, that college, higher education almost sells itself using that story of you come to college and you figure out who you are and you have to explore everything. It's like a cafeteria. You have to try everything and then you figure out who you are. But I kind of asked that question, why does it have to be like that? Why do you have to try everything? It's not necessary to try everything. And you can remain within your communities. And for example, for some scholars of higher education, they say when you go to college, you kind of have to transcend your previous communities. And to some degree, when you go to college, you kind of encounter that you're kind of expected to go beyond what you were before. But I don't agree with that. And I think that's kind of not fair, especially to students from minority communities who are actually possibly for the first time in this space where they're able to kind of find, you know, their own communities. For example, I had a young woman who had all her life grown up in a small town where she was the only Muslim, and her high school, she was the only Muslim. And for the first time, she comes to college and she finds like an MSA. For the first time, she finds a Muslim student community and she wants to kind of be part of it. She wants to be comfortable in it. And then people look at her and go, oh, you're just going to stay in your bubble, are you? But that's not right, right? That doesn't work that way for minority students. For this is possibly the first time that they're able to kind of engage with their minority identity. So it's not really fair to treat them and to have those kinds of expectations of them. But what I found for Muslim students in campus is that there is that, the pull factor of cultural assimilation, the pull factor of saying you really have to become part of this mainstream campus culture. This is really, really important. There's that pull factor is on the one hand, and also there's that push factor of stigma, that your religious identity is very often associated with stigma. So both of those forces, those pressures, add up to make it very difficult for many Muslim American college students to continue to embody their religious identities.
After the break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Shaban Amir, Associate Professor at American Islamic College. Tonight's show is pre-recorded, so we will not be able to take your questions or comments on air. We look forward to continuing the conversation online. If you have any comments or concerns, please tweet us at Radio Islam USA or post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Radio Islam USA.
Did you know that birthday parties help build confidence in kids?
Yeah. Did you know that giving kids less sugar before bedtime helps them sleep better?
Oh, totally. Did you know that friendly kids have more friends?
Everybody knows that.
Hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
I didn't know that.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
When Dad needed help getting around, I became his driver. Soon enough, it was up to me to be his housekeeper and financial manager, too. When he moved in, I became his cook and even his nurse. But no matter what roles I play, I know I'm still his daughter.
We understand the roles you play. So to help, we created AARP.org/caregiving, where you can connect with experts and other caregivers. Visit AARP.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Radio Islam is pleased to bring you another signature production, Nutrition That Fits, with registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator, Hannah El-Amin.
This is registered dietitian Hannah El-Amin with Nutrition That Fits for Radio Islam, giving nutrition advice that fits your life, your needs, and your goals. What's the first food that comes to mind when you think of a quick breakfast option? Tea and crumpets? I doubt it. If you said cereal, then we're thinking along the same lines. cereal is the most popular breakfast choice in the U.S. However, trying to pick out the perfect cereal can be a bit overwhelming. There are so many choices, and these days, even the most questionable breakfast cereal manages to make some sort of creative health claim. I'm going to give you a few simple tips to help pick out a healthy, tasty cereal that's right for you and your family. First, seek out fiber and protein. Both will help you fill up and keep you fuller longer after the meal. Fiber also helps keep those insides clean and healthy. A good cereal should have at least 3 grams of both fiber and protein. Next are the things you want to limit. Try to avoid cereals with too much sugar. Try to keep it under 8 grams per serving. Lastly, saturated fat is something to avoid in a cereal. It's bad for your arteries, leading to decreased blood flow and ultimately less energy. This is no way to start your day. Make sure your cereal has no saturated fat at all. To make this breakfast even more perfect, pair your cereal with low-fat milk, whether it be cow's milk, soy, hemp, or almond milk, and have it with a piece of fresh fruit for a perfectly rounded meal. So remember, at least 3 grams of filling fiber and protein, no more than 8 grams of sugar, and ditch the saturated fat completely. Pair that perfect bowl of cereal with a piece of fresh fruit and you will be off to a good start. For more questions on this or other nutrition topics, be sure to visit NutritionThatFits.com. Until next time, this is Hannah El Amin with Nutrition That Fits for Radio Islam, giving nutrition advice that fits your life, your needs, and your goals.
Welcome back. You're listening to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM Chicago. We reach the world by streaming live at radioislam.com, where you can view all of our prior shows. Radio Islam is a call and talk show every night from 6 to 7 p.m. Central Time. Though tonight's program is pre-recorded, you can post questions and comments on our Facebook page at facebook.com/radioislamusa. Tonight's program is a conversation with Dr. Shaban Amir, Associate Professor at American Islamic College and author of the award-winning book, Muslim American Women on Campus, Undergraduate Social Life and Identity, discussing her findings.
So the question you asked was, how can Muslim college students protect their faith and maintain their religious identities? And one of the solutions for this is what we call enclaves or private spaces. So you can have a Muslim student association. You can have a small group. You can have like a study circle or something. And a lot of students really got a lot of comfort from those spaces, and they were able to learn more about their religion and become a part of a community and find that community. And for many, many Muslim students, actually, college is the first time they're able to find that community. And I think those are really important spaces. I've also done some writing about that issue. I think that private community spaces are really, really important, because it's one thing to have an MSA that's often doing, for example, public events like Islam Awareness Week, right? What is the purpose of Islam Awareness Week? The purpose of Islam Awareness Week usually is to educate the broader campus, right? And that's good. That's important. But on the other hand, you also want those spaces where you're just taking care of yourselves. So in white-majority society, and particularly in white-majority campuses, I think that it's really important to have those private spaces for Muslim students. There are multiple reasons for that. One is, of course, religious identity, to strengthen religious identities. And the other is also the issue of stigma, to have safe spaces where you are not constantly saying, no, I'm a Muslim woman and I'm not oppressed. Or, yes, I'm a Muslim man and I'm not a terrorist, for example, right? Where you're not having to constantly explain those things. Now, I teach, for example, I teach at American Islamic College, and that's one of the things that I found very emancipatory about teaching in a Muslim college. I had never actually thought that I would teach in a Muslim college. And then I ended up here in 2015. And this is one of the things that I really love about this space is that we have a Muslim space, and we can discuss, for example, things like gender, right? And we don't have to worry about explaining to people who have all these stereotypes about Muslims and gender and sexism and misogyny, etc. And we can, at the same time, we can explore more and critique our own communities more. And we can say, what are the things that are wrong that we can fix without having to constantly say, oh, by the way, that we're human and we do have some flaws. So these are some of the things that I think are very, very useful for protecting religious identities, private spaces. I think they're really, really important.
No, that's a great point, because I think sometimes I'm a convert myself, so sometimes the idea or thought of trying to critique necessarily the Muslim community, but within people who are not Muslim, to them it's just like, why are you there? It's just a bunch of crazy people. It's like, no, it's just, you know, it's just like any community ever. So,
yeah.
So, for a lot of the sisters who were in the study, like, did you ever find that it affected their schoolwork from the stress of trying to sort of balance, like, two lives or anything like that? Or did they kind of make it way through?
Yeah. So, so remember when I was doing my study, right? I did my study. I started my research study in 2002. And this was a time that was very stressful for everybody. This was not long after 9/11. Also, the site of the research study was Washington, D.C. And you remember that one of the attacks was, you know, the Pentagon was targeted as well.
Right.
So this was a high stress time for the Muslim community of Washington, D.C. in particular. And I had research participants who had friends whose homes had been raided. Their parents, for example, offices had been raided. These were community leaders who had been leading the effort to create a Muslim American community that engaged with the broader community politically, socially, in so many different ways, in very positive ways. And yet they had the FBI, for example, raiding their homes, breaking into homes, taking pictures of women who used to wear hijab without their hijab. You know, these kinds of things were happening. So these kinds of violences were sort of ever-present at that time. So this was a very high stress time. And so for a lot of my research participants, thinking about these issues was very stressful. So doing their, of course, their coursework and everything else, that was on the other side. And then thinking about their futures. So thinking about, oh, I'm going to be, for example, what is the career that I'm going to follow? Is my career going to be, for example, in public policy? Oh, wait, am I going to constantly be explaining to people that I'm human and I'm Muslim and I'm not, you know, a terrorist or oppressed or sexist and so on? Am I constantly going to be doing that? Or should I just go with some kind of quiet career where I don't have to do those things, where I can just, you know, make a bunch of money and donate it to good causes or something like that, right? So these were real struggles that people were going through. And on the other hand, then there were the people who were actively involved with such representative jobs as being Muslim Student Association members, officers, and so on. And their job was to explain to people, to, you know, give people information that they didn't have, and then to do it over and over and over again, and then to engage in these kind of polemics all the time. So, for example, right after 9/11, there were these constant questions being raised about terrorism, about the Muslim world, about the Middle East, and so on. So people were very tired a lot of the time. I just got that from my research participants all the time. They were just very tired. And for some of them, sometimes in the middle of an interview, it was almost like just they wanted to stop talking and start crying. Mm-hmm. Right. So that was really hard. And that, alongside your regular identity struggles of being Muslim and being American at the same time, and having to explain that, yes, you were Muslim and you were American at the same time, and that there was not a conflict between these things. So, for example, one of my research participants I talk about in my book, I call her Intisar, and she was Somali-American, and she played basketball. And one of the things she was constantly encountering was people saying, wait, you're Muslim. Are you allowed to play basketball? Are you supposed to play basketball? Aren't you Muslim women all, like, immobile, and you wear burqas, and you're not supposed to be moving around or anything? So these kinds of questions that were hounding them all the time. And I think they did just a kick-ass job. I think they just did an amazing job of being themselves, and in so many different ways. I mean, after I did my research, even during it, and after, every time I look at my my book and my research data, I am in awe of these young women. I mean, I was a lot older than them, but every time I spoke to them, I just found them so amazing. They're awe-inspiring. And they were just, you know, undergraduates, just young undergraduates doing their thing.
Wow, yeah. And so have you had a chance to, like, follow up with them and see, like, where they are now? And
oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, many of them continue to be my very good friends.
Good.
So, absolutely. I mean, you know, this was, this was 2002. So now they're, you know, having families and pursuing careers, doing really, really well, mashallah. And so I'm just so happy every time I see them have any kind of success. And, you know, now what I'd really like to do is follow up and do research on campus now and see what's different now. You know, we've had a number of different political and social changes. When I did my research, you know, George Bush was president, and we had 9/11, then we had that war on terror, the war in Iraq, and so on, a continuing war in Afghanistan, which is, you know, it's experienced by Muslim Americans constantly as a form of violence. So now we have a whole other era going on with the election of Trump, and the bomb that was just they're thrown on, you know, Nangarhar in Afghanistan. So now I would like to do some more research and, you know, talk to college students and see what's going on with them now. How are they experiencing college campus now? What does it feel like now to be Muslim? What has changed? What is different? So now you've also had, you know, like a vibrant Black Lives Matter movement. You've had a nationwide, you know, No Dapple movement, where we ally ourselves with our Native sisters and brothers. So now, what is changing with the Muslim American identity? In what ways are we reaching out to our allies and building bridges and creating new things in our communities? I'd really, really love to do that research now. I think Chicago would be a great place to follow up.
No, I think so. That would be, especially just given, like, the bans on travel bans. And,
that's right.
You know, whether students would actually want to come study if they're international.
Goodness,
you know, where do they
yes.
want to come and go from there? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So thank you so much, Dr. Mir. It's been, like, a really great conversation.
Thank you for having me.
No problem.
I'm always delighted to be, you know, involved with Radio Islam.
Absolutely. Is there anything you wanted to add, though, or did I miss anything?
Wanted to say, you know, thank you for having me and, you know, listen to Radio Islam and also come check us out at American Islamic College.
Yeah, definitely. And then I guess if for our listeners to listen, check out your book. It sounds like really interesting research that will,
do check out my book. It's called Muslim American Women on Campus, Undergraduate Social Life and Identity. It was published in 2014. And I do have some articles as well, if you want to check them out as well. And I always love to hear from people if they do have any feedback on the book.
Oh, absolutely. Wonderful. Well, they'll definitely check it out then and, you know, maybe continue this conversation with you.
That would be wonderful.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Olivia.
All right. Thank you.
How to be a great dad in 15 seconds. Bike ride, go fish, walk in the park, phone call, milkshake, play catch, picnic, fly a kite, tell jokes, laugh, talk, read a story, tell a story, bumper car, swing set, bowling, pillow fight, cut loose, stay tight. Whew. Because the smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Nurse, set up an IV. And you, her boyfriend, you with the driver?
Yes, doctor, but I didn't mean to hurt her. I only had a few drinks. I was just buzzed.
Just buzzed? Oh, then your girlfriend is fine.
Hey, sweetie, I feel great.
She's really okay?
What, are you kidding? No, not really. Nurse, get me a suture kit. Stat.
Buzzed driving. Maybe we should stop acting like it's no big deal. Buzzed driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. The only thing I didn't learn in school today is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Radio Islam now presents Marked in Time with historian Faraz El-Khatib.
Assalamu alaikum and peace be upon you. When we think of great explorers and sailors, the names that come to mind are usually the ones that we learned about in school. Columbus, Magellan, Marco Polo, and others. But one name that we don't usually learn about in the West is Zheng He. He was a Chinese admiral in the early 1400s and is commonly regarded as China's greatest explorer of all time. But he was also a Muslim, and he helped establish strong diplomatic relations between China and Muslim states throughout the Indian Ocean region. Zheng He was born in 1371 to a Hui family. Hui is the name given to China's Muslim community that is no different ethnically and culturally from the bulk of China's people. He managed to get a job serving the Ming Emperor of China by the early 1400s, and in 1405 was appointed as the head of a giant expedition with the goal of establishing diplomatic relations with China's maritime neighbors. Between 1405 and 1433, Zheng He commanded 7 voyages, each of which had at least 30,000 people, and he sailed as far as Malaysia, Indonesia, India, Persia, Yemen, and Kenya. He may have even taken his navy to Mecca so that he and the other Muslims with him could do the Hajj. Besides just being a great explorer and diplomat, Zheng He also helped spread Islam in the regions which he traveled to. In Southeast Asia, he supported Muslim communities with finances as well as with scholars who helped educate the local population and spread Islam throughout the region. Many communities in Malaysia and Indonesia see him as one of the greatest figures in the Islamization of their countries. Today, Indonesia has the largest Muslim population of any country in the world, and much of that can be attributed to this great Muslim sailor, China's greatest explorer of all time. I'm historian Faraz El-Khatib with Marked in Time for Radio Islam. Thanks for listening.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
Before you go, you should know Radio Islam is now hiring interns. Whether you have experience or are looking for experience, we have an opportunity for you. Radio Salaam prides itself on giving interns unparalleled, hands-on experience all in the heart of downtown Chicago. To find out more about our open positions in producing, social media, and database management, send us an email at producer@radioslam.com. You have been listening to Radio Salaam, a call and talk show from 6 to 7 p.m. 7 days a week on WCEV 1450 a.m. To find out more about tonight's guests and their work, hop on to soundcloud.com/Radio Salaam USA, where you can also stream, download, and comment on our shows. You can catch us on iTunes and Google Play and stream straight from your phone. And don't forget to rate and view our podcast. Follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook at Radio Salaam USA. The executive producer of Radio Salaam is Abdul Malik Mujahid. The producer today has been Olivia Richardson. Our engineer this evening is Raymond. Radio Salaam is a Sound Vision Foundation production. Views expressed are the views of the host and of the guest, not of the Sound Vision Foundation. I'm your host, Olivia Richardson. Join us tomorrow evening for another great show on Radio Salaam. Thank you.